So I'm going to read it to you again. Hopefully when you memorize it, it's a lot easier to work with a sutta because it's just there for you. Yeah? So I'll just keep reading it to you and then slowly it's sinking in. While breathing in long, one knows, I breathe in long. While breathing out long, one knows, I breathe out long. While breathing in short, one knows, I breathe in short. While breathing out short, one knows, I breathe out short. One trains oneself sensitive to the whole body, I breathe in. Sensitive to the whole body, I breathe out. One trains oneself calming the whole body, I breathe in. Calming the whole body, I breathe out. In the Vedana group, one trains oneself sensitive to PT, I breathe in. Sensitive to PT, I breathe out. One trains oneself sensitive to sukha, I breathe in. Sensitive to sukha, I breathe out. One trains oneself sensitive to mental processes, I breathe in. Sensitive to mental processes, I breathe out. One trains oneself calming mental processes, I breathe in. Calming mental processes, I breathe out. The mind group. One trains oneself sensitive to the mind, I breathe in. Sensitive to the mind, I breathe out. One trains oneself gladdening the mind, I breathe in. Gladdening the mind, I breathe out. One trains oneself steadying the mind, I breathe in. Steadying the mind, I breathe out. One trains oneself liberating the mind, I breathe in. Liberating the mind, I breathe out. And I'll just read you a nice bit from Larry Rosenberg on experiencing the mind. And this is on the ninth contemplation, which we've been practicing, sensitive to the mind, you know, we're hearing about. The challenge of the ninth contemplation is to experience the mind thoroughly and fully, just as it is, with whatever level of clarity we have. As we do that, we begin to see that mindfulness takes the energy out of our mind states so that they arise, but no longer have so much power to push us around. We no longer act automatically at their commands. There is then not as much suffering if a difficult emotion comes up, even something as strong as anger or fear. We've grown intimate with these mind states, and that changes our relation to them. They're coming from our own storehouse of consciousness, right out of our hearts. We are learning to observe these states in a friendly way, instead of identifying with them, resisting them, or rejecting them. The point is to change our mind from a battlefield where we're always fighting these states or getting lost in them to a place of peaceful coexistence. Then these visitors, these guests in consciousness, don't have such power. What we will see eventually when we get to the 13th contemplation is that they are all impermanent and lack a substantial self. Right now, we're mainly learning to recognize and open up to them, but we can't help sometimes noticing that they arise and pass away. Anger, when you look at it closely, is not a steady stream of emotion, but a complex state that is constantly changing in intensity and finally disappears altogether. Anger is a movement of energy that comes and goes. It can't possibly characterize a human being. It doesn't have any enduring substance. As we see everything coming and going, the breathing, feeling, mind states, we begin also to see that the whole notion of a self who is doing these things is imaginary. As that lifelong notion falls away altogether, or at least weakens, we drop a heavy burden. We can rejoice in our self-knowledge. It's not a grim assignment that we're condemned to carry out all the time, but a helpful practice that is making our life lighter. We tap into a certain joy at the heart of the practice. In time, as you see them again and again, these mind states lose their potency. It is not necessarily a problem to be visited by anger or craving or fear. This isn't an ideology. It's okay to be fearful, but an actual fact. You're fearful and it's all right. It becomes easier to turn to these states and experience them directly, just as it has become easier to allow each breath to follow its own nature. When that happens, these states start thinning out, falling away. The direction of meditation is for everything to go back where it came from. It comes out of stillness and goes back to stillness. As the mind grows quiet and still, our sense of psychological time falls away, and we open up to a vast spaciousness. It has been there all along, behind our agitation. The ancients spoke of the sky that is beyond the clouds. The productions of the mind are like clouds, some beautiful, some dark and threatening, but they are all clouds in the sky of the mind. The sky is vast, glorious, and unchanging, was never born, and never dies. Most of us live at the level of the clouds. We barely know there is a sky. And the way to the sky is through the clouds, by studying them, observing them carefully in a friendly and unbiased way. In time, as we do that, they pass away, the same way a feeling passes away when we bring mindfulness to it. Then we open up to something altogether different, vast and silent, full of energy and love, of every kind of nourishment we need. We realize it has been there all along. So you may be in the middle of a dark storm cloud and that silence seems rather doubtful, that spaciousness. Yeah, so this is describing something that can happen if we stay with it over time. And we can't will it. So most basically, we're just experiencing the mind. Like most basically in the body tetra, just experiencing the body. In the Vedana tetra, just experiencing feeling, pleasant, painful, neutral. That's where we start. If it's confusing, that's where you start. And then as you notice them, something of the nature of having Vedana or a body starts to make itself known. But that's not an idea we need to impose onto the practice. Yeah, we're just with the breath and body. In the first tetrad and the second tetrad, we're just with pleasant, painful, and neutral feeling. And then we just see what reveals itself to us if we're just willing to be with it. And in the mind, we're just experiencing the mind as it is, particularly noticing its interpretations, its labels, its stories, which is samnya or perception. Noticing its movements, contracting, opening, our volitions, its movement of habit energy. You're not even making it do anything in particular. I don't know what happened when we just stopped meditating as far as making an effort. What kept going on in a way then? What was left when there was no self deciding that I was going to do this or that or make my mind do a somersault or whatever we do? So sometimes you just see that habit energy playing out. Sometimes when we stop doing just pure awareness, that sky starts to shine through. And that brings us into consciousness, just underneath everything. Awareness. Tibetans speak of the ground of awareness. It's like, boom, it's there. Yeah. It's not mine, it's not yours, it's just awareness. And we don't have to create it. I did have a moment on my solitary where it was a flash. But I wasn't being aware, and there was awareness. I wasn't trying to be aware, and there was just awareness. In a simple way, like I could hear the guy in the yurt down the valley whistling. And I wasn't trying to do that. Okay, so we're going to start to look at particularly the sky-like nature of mind, explore that. So we've looked at the hindrances, the kleshas, we've looked at contracted mind, and I've asked you, well, just explore for yourself. When the mind's not so contracted, what is there? What's the qualities you discover? So I'm not sure what people have found, but we're going to explore that more. And there's a great thing that the Buddha said very early on in the Pali Canon, it appears a few places. He says, "This mind is luminous, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements." So it's like the mind is clear, luminous, bright, but it's kind of covered over. Adventitious is a great word. They just creep in there. Given the chance, they like to creep in there, these things that cloud that over. obscure that nature from us. And so we experience ourselves as an enemy or a problem, or we're not very aware, generally. So, if we're becoming sensitive to the mind, it's an option just to be sensitive to the luminous nature of mind, yeah? It's a very unproblem-oriented way to relate to your mind. And it's so simple. It's very simple. Yeah, so we've gone through the kind of Theravadin way of working through various categories. And now we're on to spaciousness. I have to say, personally, when I practice the Anapanasati Sutta, it just ends up in something very open. By the time I get to the mind, then I just tend to work in this very open way. So I'm going to share that with you. Some of the other ways, when it says, what are we becoming sensitive to? And it says, thought. And then from the Satipatthana Sutta, there's some categories. We're not going to do all those. They're just things that, over the course of the years, if you're on a solitary, you might notice some of these characteristics. Just like location, duration, quality with the breath. There's some characteristics you can notice with the mind. Okay, but we're going to specifically become sensitive to the luminous nature of mind. The sky's gotten a little clearer, hasn't it? So it's the result of all your good work. If we're in California, we might have an earthquake now, because in the Mahayana, the earth trembles when lots of good stuff is happening. Which has happened on retreat. Each person just thinks they're having a fad meditation, and then the plants are swinging in the air. Just an earthquake. Okay, so, you know, we've already said when we're sensitive to our experience and we're looking out for a characteristic or an aspect of our experience, we can't force it, right? We're just sensitive to. So we had the idea of turning on a radar, turning on our sensing, and just being open to the possibility of something arising. So I think we can't force being sensitive to the luminous nature of mind either. All we can do is be open to it. I think it relates very much to what Sadhanandi said before the puja yesterday about being around the Buddha. Something like that quality of consciousness or experience is always there if we're willing to sit with it. And here we are sitting down with the Buddha in the shrine room. You know, the stories from the Pali Canon, the Buddha and these thousands of monks are meditating in the woods, right? And I think it's the Samanafala, yeah. So this king decides he's going to go see the Buddha, right? And it's dark, and he's going to the forest, and Jivaka, this doctor, is bringing him there, saying, okay, I'll take you to the Buddha. And this guy starts getting incredibly paranoid, because it's so quiet, he thinks. There can't be, you know, 1,000 monks and the Buddha meditating here. This is some kind of plot to bring me out in the woods and get rid of me. So he starts getting very nervous, and Jivaka keeps saying, no, it's fine, it's fine. So there's our willingness to approach that experience. Going into the woods, great image. Yeah, leaving behind the familiar and being willing to experience, become closer to that possibility, which means we need to leave things behind, or we need to let things go. Yeah, going into the forest, that's what that symbolizes. So another interesting thing that's been said that I think helps is Vijayamala talks about relaxation is what's there when we stop producing or creating tension. So this relaxed, open awareness, this luminous mind is what's there when we stop creating tension, when we stop anxiously creating the self, which we have to create moment after moment. It constantly requires our maintenance in terms of believing all these stories about this being me, you know, solidifying down into something quite small and tight. Looking at the sky, it just gives us a sense of something a bit more spacious, great image, or something unbounded and not so contracted, tightening back into something we think of as me that's safe. Okay, so this might help. This is from Alan Wallace, who wrote us that little bit about the release way of working. We were talking about our aboriginal nature. The moon behind the clouds, another image. We're talking about the sky behind the clouds. And here he talks about primordial awareness. So all these things mean we're not creating this. We're not fabricating this awareness. We don't have to create it. It is actually there. Buddha mind, Dharmakaya. Yeah. We don't own it. It is happening now. Okay, when I say what's happening now, that is one of the things that is happening now. We may not be sensitive to it, but it's happening right now. Okay? Because it's there. And it's not so much an it, it's a quality of consciousness. Okay, so primordial awareness, which is referred to as unborn awareness in the mind training, is also referred to as the clear light nature of the mind, or Rigpa in Tibetan. Rigpa is awareness that is beyond subject-object duality. Dzogchen Lingpa, a great Dzogchen master who lived in the latter part of the 19th and early 20th century, said it is extremely important to understand the difference between mind, as we normally experience it, and unborn awareness. The difference is that mind is locked into structures, conditioned, saturated with conceptual frameworks, distinctions between subject, object, existence, non-existence, good, bad, up, down, Buddha, ordinary sentient being, samsara, nirvana, etc. Mind is not only saturated with conceptual frameworks, it reifies itself and its objects, assuming them to have their own intrinsic nature. We believe in a personal identity, and when we look at another person, we believe also in his or her absolute identity, separate from our own. The mind works in conceptual frameworks and reifies the results. Mind configured by conceptual frameworks contrasts with unborn awareness. The experience of unborn awareness entails a spacious dissolution, or melting, into a great expanse with no object, without obstruction, and without intentionality. Unborn awareness is the effortless realization that all phenomenon, the self included, lack an independent, self-sufficient nature. The dualistic mind and unborn awareness are very different. The former is awareness that has become deluded. To penetrate the nature of mind is to see that it never was anything other than unborn awareness. Okay, I'll say that again. To penetrate the nature of mind is to see that it was never anything other than unborn awareness. To use a Tibetan metaphor, unborn awareness is like water. Mind is like ice. And yet ice is nothing other than water in a different form. So this is a kind of faith-based approach to the mind, I think. It involves faith. So it's kind of a bridge to the next contemplation. Okay. The view of the mind from the Vajrayana, Mahamudra, or Dzogchen traditions has three qualities. Its essence is shunya, with no solidity, not fixed, unfolding. Which is why we can't, why we get so tense when we try to fix our meditation experience and clamp down on it. We can't do that with our mind either. It's just shunya. It's not like we need a mind that's going to then look at shunya around us. We are shunya, this process of unfolding. And the mind's nature is luminous, or knowing, cognizance, awareness, radiance. Yeah, so it's not dull. So when I'm saying mind now, I mean in this unborn awareness sense, right? So we can experience our mind as dull, but that's the defiled mind, yeah? It's not the mind that's luminous, unborn awareness. So Zen makes a helpful way of, has helpful vocabulary, small mind, big mind, yeah? So we'll use that. Small mind can be very confused and dim. Big mind is luminous by nature. We don't have to make it luminous. It is luminous. And its activity is compassionate or responsive, kind, creative, uninhibited, spontaneous. We don't have to make it that way. That is its characteristic. So that's why, have you heard Milarepa's song of Yogi's Joy? So why is this guy saying, oh, happy are the myriad manifestations. The more ups and downs, the more joy I feel. Why does he say, happy indeed are the countless confusions. The greater the fear, the greater the happiness I feel. Why does he say, the greater the distress and passions, the more one can be blithe and gay. What happiness to feel no ailment or illness. What happiness to feel that joy and suffering are one. What happiness to play in bodily movement with the power aroused by yoga. To jump and run, to dance and leap is more joyful still. What happiness to sing the victorious song. What happiness to chant and hum. More joyful still to talk and loudly sing. Happy is the mind, powerful and confident, steep in the realm of totality. So if we don't have this dualistic framework, we're saying, well, what's happening now is bad. And I want something good to be happening. Yeah? And we just relate to it all as this is shunya, it's just coming and going. It's just the play of mind, of this rigpa, of big mind. It's also an image of waves on an ocean, yeah. So if we don't polarize with it and we don't fix it, it just comes and goes. There's nothing solid about it. And we can just enjoy the actual energy without being fooled by it, you know, without getting lost in it. It's just the natural power of the mind, the natural vibrancy of the mind. I've been meditating a lot over the past month and a half. And my mind does feel a lot more vibrant. It's interesting. Just noticing that characteristic, aliveness. I just feel more awake, relatively more awake. So that's possibly there. If we just gradually stop creating tension, learn how to stop creating tension, that is what we're told, we'll be there. So you can see, sensitive to the mind, I breathe in, sensitive to the mind, I breathe out. Important that we're not creating this, right? So we're not creating the tension of trying to create something that's shunya, something that's luminous, and something that's compassionate, yeah? Won't work. You'll just get tense. So it's kind of like, well, it's a possibility, and we're just open to that. One translation of shunyata is the open dimension of being. So in a way to approximate it, if we're just open, we can approach it. So even as you are having an internal rant about someone, it is there. So we don't create tension. Sometimes it's very helpful to use the four right efforts and substitute the wholesome for the unwholesome and actually intervene. Okay, so it's not that that's unhelpful. We're just working a different way. So we're not going to do that. You just let that happen. You just release the mind. It's shunya. You don't need to solidify that as a problem and then try to fix it. You're just getting stuck in small mind, you could say. Yeah? So you just release it. And maybe just try to relate to its energy. Very tantric thing, right? Anger, working with anger, the energy of anger to bring about awakening. Don't get lost in the content. Just experience the energy of it. Release the mind. If it contracts, we're just trying to gently just let anything that we're clamping on to be prepared to let it go. And the breath can be really helpful. So we can use the out-breath, letting the out-breath go. As we let the out-breath go, we can imagine it extending the mind out. We're just giving us more spaciousness, yeah. The cells in a body can move further apart. Our thoughts can drift further apart. We can just let everything be. So we're using the breath as a relaxation tool. And even a few more conscious breaths, I think, can be really helpful so that yeah. If you're alone, you can do it a little bit more loudly. Since we're with others, we might try to not get too loud. But you know, whatever. It's for you know, if you hear someone doing it next to you, they're just it's for their own spiritual benefit, so you can be happy about it. You know. I think the danger with this way of working is just being totally lost. So you're saying I'm just releasing and relaxing, mm-hmm. but what you're doing is just being totally lost in what's happening. So there isn't an element of luminosity. So what's helpful is to use the breath. And the body is a way of getting concentrated and then opening the mind. And actually, I think for people newer to meditation, it's more beneficial to focus on the samatha aspect with more form. So you can try this, but I think unless you're really familiar for yourself what's the difference between being aware and being lost, it will be very hard for you not just to be lost. Yeah. So I think this way of working will sort of naturally sort of want to start happening. It's very good in the beginning to have some wise discipline. But in a way, you're doing a version of it by just letting everything be, right? So it's a version of it. And then at some point in your practice, you may come to a point where it feels that what you're doing isn't working anymore. It's just the wrong thing to be doing. Yeah, it almost feels violent. Whereas I think even up to that point of feeling that, it was a very skillful way to work. Maybe there were moments where you're too tight with it. Yeah, at some point down the line, you may feel it just feels intuitively like you need a more open way of working. So actually the next contemplations will help us do this work. But everyone kind of getting the gist, we're sensitive to this deepest aspect of mind. So the fourth dedication you could say at the end of a sit, which is very Zen, which is steep in this tradition actually. Zen is based on this Aboriginal nature of mind. That's the view that underlines Zen practice. So they say, may all beings be well, may all beings be free from suffering, and may we come to either rest in or know our own deepest nature. Nice. It's a wish for all of us. Okay, so I think one thing is just having this view in mind, just even dharmically, just as a dharmic principle, can help us be less despondent about our mind. Yeah, I don't know what you found. I went on the solitary after 10 years of meditating, thinking, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to see all the fruit of my practice. You know, like a little trophy is going to appear. So knowing the evidence of my practice, right? And my mind, I thought it was going to be total clarity, no thoughts, and, you know, just boundless love, right? So I get there, and I've never had a more superficial content in my mind, and relentless. Okay, so a couple weeks of one-liners from bad songs, worrying about what I was going to eat, you know, just dribble, just junk. And it just didn't stop. I was there for a couple weeks, it just didn't ever stop. I thought, oh, well, this is just, you know, the demons appearing and they will clear away, and it just kept going and going. So I really did get what I was looking for, yeah. Because I was able to stay with it. And just having clarity that was happening, and then just relaxing about it. There was clarity, though. I wasn't lost in it. It was great, you know? And it's like, okay, this is the fruit of 10 years of meditation. I am aware of how confused I am, and I am experiencing it. It's not just an idea. I am experiencing that confused mind. It's fantastic. It was a real turning point. Before I got to that point, I was thinking, well, what's the use of 10 years of meditating if this is what I get, right? So before that, there was doubt. I meditated 10 years for this, you know. I could have done this without meditating. Yeah. So it was like letting go of any striving, yeah, and just being with what was. So that was a real turning point in my practice, too. That came along with just being clear of the confusion. And then this other dimension opened up, this dimension of relaxing into this deeper nature of mind. Because it was like I had to purify that fabricating willful mind a little bit to create some possibility for a different way of working.